Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
Adam, today we get to talk with Dr. Diane Shannon, writer and physician, about medicine and burnout, an important topic for all physicians and for patients as well.
Yeah, I think, Christy, this is an interesting question about what causes physicians to stop practicing medicine, sometimes really right as they're just getting started. And I think what we might learn might be surprising for many of our listeners and maybe important for the training of lots of our physicians that you help lead over at University of North Carolina.
Absolutely. But first, we have some research that matters. We're going to talk about leg ulcers and different treatments.
About drugs versus interventions if you've got heart disease.
About food cravings for sugar versus fat.
And then with surgeons, is the surgeon who just graduates from residency, despite an additional 5 or 7 years, capable to do common surgeries?
An important question. Let's start off about leg ulcers. So we all know these are common, oftentimes because blood flow, where people might get a wound that is hard to heal.
And we also know that lots of times the way leg ulcers are treated is with these compression bandages, sometimes simple wrapping of gauze, and another time these medicated bandages called Una boots, kind of a strange name, Una boots. But physicians have to put them on, and they have to be changed every several days.
So this was a study looking at people who had leg ulcers to determine if there was a difference in outcomes or the time it takes to heal or the overall improvement of these ulcers, whether people used the special compression bandages or if they just used compression stockings.
And this was done in the National Health Service in England with 454 people looking at these two different methods. It's called the Venous Leg Ulcer Study. And what they really found is that there was really no difference, Christy, between doing these compression stockings or the bandages that were put on in the office setting.
And so, basically, the leg ulcers took the same time to heal, whether people wore the compression stockings or those traditional bandages that did require a lot more nurse visits. And then there was less ulcer recurrence after using just the regular stockings compared with those fancy bandages.
And this research that was done in the Lancet Journal could be one of those research studies that does help change practice. It is less expensive over the long term to use these compression stockings, assuming that the insurance companies will pay for them like they do for the other sorts of interventions. There are some people who may not like one or the other, and it certainly wouldn't apply in all situations. If you have very, very large legs or very, very small legs, you may not be able to get the right sizes. But for a lot of people, this is a good research study.
Much easier to perform.
Let's talk about our very next research that matters, Christy. And this is about a common intervention that's done for people who have blockages in their heart called angioplasty. And is angioplasty better than perhaps routine medications if you have stable heart disease and you have to have how it's monitored?
So this was a study looking at more than 4,000 patients who had some heart disease where the blood flow doesn't work quite as well in the heart. It was led at Stony Brook University School of Medicine. It was published in JAMA, the Journal of the American Medical Association Internal Medicine Journal, and basically found what, Adam?
Well, they followed these folks for up to 5 years after they had had an intervention or this coronary angioplasty where they kind of balloon up these arteries, or they were treated with drug treatment alone. And they really looked at whether people died sooner, whether they had a heart attack that didn't cause them to die, but maybe caused them to go in the hospital, whether they had to have recurrent procedures, or whether or not they had angina, pain in their chest. And they really showed on all these types of outcomes, there was really very little and no statistical difference between the two groups.
I think a lot of times in medicine, we think that if we go in there and do something, that surely that would be better for the patient. But in this case, it shows just another example of the medications that we have are just as good in all of these outcomes as getting that angioplasty procedure performed.
And in this particular study, this was a meta-analysis where they had combined the results from multiple different studies. And that's how they concluded. And this is probably a very robust finding because it's not the results of a single study, multiple studies looking at these outcomes. So perhaps if you're a patient, this is something you really should talk with your doctor about. Would this, if you have stable heart disease, do you need to have these types of procedures done, or can you just take the medications? A good question to ask your doctor.
Absolutely. Well, let's talk about food cravings. And we're talking about a study looking at the brain activity to see what happens when 100 high school students eat sugar compared with the really fatty foods.
Well, let's just come clean right now. Are we hungry, Christy?
Well, all of this sounds good.
I mean, and if you would you have a choice? Would you rather have foods that are high in fat or foods high in sugar if you're really trying to reward your pleasure center?
If I'm really trying to reward myself, it would be sugar.
Well, you would be very much like a lot of these high school students in.
It's because I'm so young and youthful, right?
You look like you just graduated. I won't say from where, but just graduated. And in this particular study that was published in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, they really wanted to find out, in I think a very elegant way, does it matter if you give people foods that are higher in sugar or higher in fat? Which would they crave? And does this light up in certain areas of the brain that are associated with probably things like compulsive eating?
So the authors were surprised to find that sugar was so powerful a stimulus that it seemed to overshadow the fat. So even when they were combined in large amounts, so the high sugar shakes, like milkshakes, that were low in fat kind of ramped up that reward circuitry in the brain just as strongly as the ones that paired sugar and fat. And all of it, any of the sugar elements were stronger than the ones that were mostly fatty.
Yeah, those that had a high sugar intake had triple the amount of sugar, but only a quarter of the fat had a much greater impact than the others. And these are areas of the brain that really do control our desire for food. And I think there's some real take-home messages here that it is, for a lot of people with compulsive eating, it's the sugar we really should be paying attention to. At least that's, for me, a take-home message here.
Absolutely. So, I mean, that would, for those of you who are trying to eat healthy or who are trying to limit your calorie intake, you might look through your pantry and just try to cut out some of those really high sugar foods.
Because they also, not only did they cause perhaps more eating, they also cause a spike and drop in the blood sugar levels. And several hours after you've had them, you start craving more. And so this, again, can lead to repetitive eating. Well, Christy, let's have our last research that matters, which is about surgeons after they graduate from residency. Are they really prepared now to do many of the common surgeries?
Well, and as you know, and for our listeners out there, for context, several years ago, the governing bodies instituted the 80-hour work week, where that limits doctors in training to work up to 80 hours a week on average, and no more than that, which is a significant reduction from what most surgery residencies were doing at the time. And so this is one of the studies looking at the impact of that over time on what surgeons are able to do when they go out into the world.
This is a commentary and research recently in the Annals of Surgery, and really showing that there are some concerns out there. Several indicators, one of which was that surgeons who have just graduated are now almost twice as likely to not pass their oral certifying boards as before these work hours were passed. In addition, many of them, when they enter their fellowships, aren't yet competent to do some of the more common surgeries. And so I think it suggests that it's about the volume. You have to do enough volume.
Okay, well, we've had a chance to just touch on length of training for surgeons and volume.
About drug therapy, maybe just as good as some of the interventions for people with stable heart disease.
About food cravings for sugar being more addictive, perhaps, than fat.
And about stockings being as good as leg wrappings for people with stable chronic venous ulcers.
That concludes the Research That Matters portion of the show. We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll be talking with Dr. Diane Shannon, writer and physician, about medicine and burnout. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, we're talking with Dr. Diane Shannon, writer and physician, about medicine and burnout, a really important topic.
Thank you for being with us, Dr. Shannon.
Thank you for having me.
So you were an internist practicing medicine, but now are no longer in practice. Is that right?
That's right.
So give us the background on you and what made you realize you didn't want to practice medicine.
Well, I'll start by saying what drew me to medicine was probably my mother, who is a nurse midwife. And I really saw the strength and the power of that connection between her and her patients. And I wanted that in my career. What I found, both in training and when I practiced primary care, was that the system was so stressful and wasn't really supportive of that kind of connection. I found that just after 3 years in practicing, I was really exhausted and emotionally drained and didn't feel like I could provide that kind of care that I wanted to within that system.
You know, you indicated that you really felt that two things seemed to grip you. One, that in fear of making a mistake, and the other was constant worrying about patients. Boy, two big issues. Tell us about those from your experience.
Yes. And I'll say, looking back now, I've done a lot of writing on the past decade or so about patient safety. And I understand that many things have changed to become safer within our hospitals. But looking back, I can say that I had a sense, especially when I was in training, that the system wasn't quite set up to catch my errors. And as a human being, I'm going to make mistakes. But within a system that anticipates that, we can prevent those mistakes from ever harming a patient. I think I had this underlying sense that that system wasn't in place yet. And I was always worried that I would order the wrong test or the wrong dose of a drug and that my patients might experience some harm because of it.
And so what talk us through sort of your rationale and your reasoning at the time to walk away and choose a different life versus sticking it out and trying to make some changes, you know, in the practice of medicine?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll say that at the time that I left, it was clear to me that I needed to leave. My stress level, the effect on my personal life, and yet it took a long time for me to really understand the factors that led me to leave. And now that I understand them better, I can say there were just some structural problems with the system, and those are things that I believe can change. Now, as a writer, I get to look at what are those big issues that, as a clinician on the front lines, I was too busy to understand or address those issues. So I feel, in a way, I haven't left the medical profession because I am so committed to improving care. It's just in a different way.
We're talking with Dr. Diane Shannon, a physician and author, about a recent article she wrote entitled "Why She Left Medicine, A Burnt Out the Doctor's Decision to Quit." And Dr. Shannon, is the pressures and the stresses that you describe and the fear of potentially making a mistake in a really complex system, how do you think it's different or the same for physicians as it is, let's say, for pilots or for architects who are daily responsible for decisions that ensure safety and care for thousands and millions of people. How is it the same and how is it different?
Well, I'd say it's the same in that both are very complex systems, or all three, architecture, aviation, and medicine. And yet we, as physicians or care providers within the healthcare system, we see patients or people suffering, and that's a direct thing that we deal with every day. And I think we caregivers have that extra level of stress from that. I also think, though, there's a lot of great lessons that we can learn from other industries, like aviation. You know, decades ago, aviation wasn't as safe as it is today, and they implemented things like checklists so that the pilots, when they begin, they go through a series of procedures every single time. And our surgeons are now beginning to do the same thing to try to prevent some of those errors. So I think that there are really great lessons that we can learn and apply to medicine that can help make it safer for patients and a better experience, too.
You mentioned in your article sort of a different response from patients or from people who are not physicians or in the medical field compared with the response to partners or other doctors when they learned that you were leaving medicine altogether. Talk to us a little bit about that and why you think it's so.
Well, I think people who are not physicians or in the clinical world maybe not be as aware of the stresses that providers are under. And so when friends or acquaintances would ask me why I left, they wouldn't have those kind of salient experiences unless they were also clinicians. And if they were clinicians, they understood at a very visceral level some of the stresses that that I was under and that I experienced. And so I think it was easy for them to understand why someone might choose to leave. I would say, too, that, you know, to become a physician or a number of, you know, professions, or this is true, but to become a physician takes a certain amount of years of training, dedication, and also sacrifice of other life goals. You know, I personally put off getting married, I put off having children, put off some of the other kind of adult responsibilities because I was so focused on training. And I think it would be difficult to understand walking away from that unless you also felt some of the pressures and the disillusionment, I think. For me personally, it was I had gone into the profession hoping for that kind of connection, to make those differences. And yet I found that with the sense of the lack of a sense of safety or support for those kinds of connections, I wasn't able to do what I'd set out to do.
I wonder, just maybe one final question before we need to take a break. What impact do you think practicing in Boston, the mecca in the United States of where, if there's an intensity to the practice of medicine, I imagine it would be in Boston and maybe the Mayo Clinic, a few places in the country. Does that have an impact on you, do you think, and the expectations of being perfect versus maybe being a family practitioner in a more rural community?
That's a great question, and I can't answer because I only ever practiced around Boston. But I would say, you know, with my training, I trained at a community hospital that was very supportive of us as people. And my experience with, for instance, that my fellow residents when I was training, is there couldn't be more supportive people who were ready to step in. I developed pneumonia and was out for 2 weeks when I was a resident, and the others had to cover for me, and there was never a complaint. So there was that sense of camaraderie through that experience. It could well be that in a different setting, practice would be a different experience.
Well, we're going to take a short break. But when we return, we're going to continue talking with our guest, Dr. Diane Shannon, writer and physician, about medicine and burnout and the symptoms of burnout and how to avoid them. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Dr. Diane Shannon, writer and physician, about medicine and burnout. And before the break, Dr. Shannon, you shared with us your story of being a practicing internist when you decided to give up the practice of medicine to pursue non-clinical activities and ultimately writing this article about physician burnout. I know you've done a lot of research and researched what is out there about burnout among physicians. And I wonder if you could share with us a little bit about what that term means. What are the symptoms? How do we know if we're having it? Explain a little bit about burnout for us.
Well, burnout is something that it's a syndrome that affects many in the care providing professions. And some of the symptoms include a sense of being emotionally exhausted, and often a sense of cynicism about the career, about one's ability to make a difference. Also this, what they call a depersonalization, which is kind of an inability or a loss of the ability to connect with the patient as a person. So those are some of what the researchers have found in terms of a definition for burnout.
So is burnout, though, by that definition, I would say all of my colleagues at some point in time experience burnout, that's kind of a natural thing to experience when you're working long hours, perhaps not taking enough vacation or time off, and you've got stressful jobs. Where does that point cross the line to become something, though, that's unhealthy for the provider? Maybe it's all the way around, but also unhealthy, and they need to maybe think about a change.
Right. Well, I think there's this spectrum, and for one question is how many of the symptoms of burnout does the person have, and how severe are they? How much are they affecting their work and their life, their outlook on life? Do they also have symptoms of depression or potentially substance abuse? Unfortunately, the suicide rate among physicians is higher than that of other professionals, which I was surprised to learn. Among women physicians, it's actually more than two times as high as women in the general population. So clearly there's a point where physicians under pressure, are suffering.
So, I've realized I didn't tell you beforehand. I'm the residency director at UNC in the Department of Family Medicine. And one of the things that we do are some professional development exercises to try to prevent burnout, to try to teach people to recognize the signs and to talk really openly about cynicism and disillusionment and some of the things that you've mentioned. What is your sense about that, or what have you learned? Do you think there are things that we can do for our doctors in training or for ourselves over time that can help prevent that extreme burnout that would make a person walk away?
Yeah, I definitely think there are things that can be done to prevent it. Some of them are on the individual level, for physicians to really make it a priority to take care of themselves and try to achieve work-life balance. So that might mean making a commitment to take a lunch break, or it might mean taking up a hobby, or ensuring that they spend time, quality time with friends and family, which can be really difficult. But when you look at the alternative of eventually becoming burnt out and needing to leave the profession, or worse, it really becomes an imperative to take care of oneself that way. But I think also it's not strictly a problem that can be solved by an individual reducing their stress level. I think there are factors in the practice environment that can lead to burnout. And so addressing those is something that can be really important. And researchers have found that there are some specific factors associated with higher levels of burnout. One of them that I thought was really interesting is physicians who have an opportunity to spend some portion of their work week doing the sorts of professional activities that are very meaningful to them have a lower rate of burnout.
So give us an example of that.
Sure. So if there's a physician who really wants to do bench research, to find a way for the organization to find a way to support some amount of time in bench research, or if it was a physician who really wanted to provide care to disadvantaged youth, that there would be an opportunity for that person to go and do that for some portion of their work week. And they found that it makes a significant difference in the level of burnout.
You also, in your article, talk about what leaders can do. And I assume this is not limited to medicine, but leaders in a whole variety of disciplines can do and institutions can do to help prevent burnout. Can you talk about some examples of things that really help us all to be more connected?
Yes. Well, I think to start with leaders of, let's say, a hospital, I think it's important for them to understand that the investment in the support system, the infrastructure to prevent burnout, is going to reap rewards. So, for example, hiring additional staff in the outpatient clinic so that the environment is not so chaotic, reducing the panel size for physicians. You know, those are things that, yes, that is going to take additional funds to support those changes. But if in the end you can retain those physicians and if they're energized and feeling joyful about their work, then the outcomes are going to be a positive.
And you also mentioned in your article just the simple things of recognizing good care and leaders sitting down and going on hospital rounds or writing notes to people. I think this human connection from colleague to colleague is something across fields, and particularly in medicine, it's really important. I'm so glad you brought that up.
The other question, as you mentioned, reducing panel sizes and ways to nurture doctors, we also have, you know, the other pull that there aren't enough doctors for all the patients that need doctors, particularly in primary care. What do you think about the relationship between physician burnout and shortage of physicians?
I think the two are completely intertwined. And as more physicians leave practice or retire or cut back, then there's even more pressure on those who remain. I do think that some of the changes going along with health reform may help, especially the focus on more team-based care. So if some of the activities within a practice, the daily activities a physician is currently doing, if some of those that don't need necessarily to be performed by a physician could be performed by others on the healthcare team with great coordination and communication, I think that that would reduce some of that pressure, and it might help reduce the panel size or at least reduce the level of pressure on physicians, allowing them the time to really spend, you know, having those conversations with patients and doing whatever required record keeping they need to do.
You know, Dr. Shannon, in our last 30 seconds, you really have brought home very nicely how we focus a lot in medicine on safety and compassion and quality of care for patients, and you want to make sure that we do the same for the providers. In your new career as a writer, how has your experience and knowledge influenced your writing?
Well, it's what I'm devoted to doing. I've, for the past decade, have been focused on improving the healthcare system through writing, through focusing on those individuals and organizations that are making a difference, that are doing things differently. And in the end, it comes full circle to improving care for patients.
Well, we want to thank you so much for being our guest today. We've been talking with Dr. Diane Shannon, writer and physician, about medicine and burnout. Thank you so much.
Thank you for being with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Adam and I will spend a little bit of time talking about your health questions and your concerns.
We'd like you to send us any of your own questions, any of your own concerns, stories, whatever you'd like us to talk about, and we'll talk about it on an upcoming show. You can send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu.
And
we'd like to ask our executive producer, Erica Lloyd, to read us our very first House Call question.
My dad is 58 years old and has been experiencing neck pain for the last few months. After finally listening to my mother, he went to see a doctor. He was told by the doctor that he had a degenerating disc, and it was not something that he would greatly impact his well-being. What causes a disc to degenerate, and can a person become paralyzed from this?
Well, boy, there's a lot of questions in there, and there's a lot of concern, and I bet a lot of our listeners, Christy, share these concerns.
Yeah, and degenerative disc disease is sort of in a spectrum of those discs in your spine that don't sort of have the same sort of thickness and buoyancy, and it's closely related with arthritis that can happen, you know, in a person's neck or back over time.
And virtually everyone's going to get some amount of arthritis somewhere in their body. And doctors throw terms around like degenerative disc or DJD, and then we say arthritis. And unfortunately, I think what people hear, Christy, is something very, very different. When I hear degeneration, I think about, oh, nerves that aren't going to be working anymore and something really bad, but it isn't necessarily good that you might have pain for a long period of time, but it's not like this is going to shorten your lifespan either.
Right. And it's also confusing because the neck pain might be related to that degenerative disc disease, but also, I mean, most people at your age will have a little bit in their neck and if you do imaging and take pictures of it. And so it might just be that you have that, but it may not be the exact cause of your pain.
And finally, if we go to the end of the spectrum, as people get much older, a lot of times they'll have something called spinal stenosis, which is also linked with these same terms. And yes, it can impact your quality of life and your well-being, but most times it can be managed with physical therapy, with different ways of non-pain medication to help out with this. So we encourage you to talk with your doctor, get in with a good physical therapist, keep your exercise, quit smoking.
That's right. I mean, when you think about the risks over time, the things that raise your risk of having these problems are age, smoking, your genetics, obesity, trauma, like if you've gotten in car accidents or had a lot of injuries, overuse, and then if you're a woman, you're more likely to have it than a man. So for those things, don't smoke and try to exercise and keep a healthy weight and hopefully prevent this and get some improvement in your neck pain over time.
What's the very next House Call, Erica?
The news has discussed the topic of antibacterial soap versus plain soap. I've used antibacterial soap since I can remember, but according to the news, the FDA is looking to the actual benefits of using antibacterial soap. What are your thoughts, and what type of soap do you have at home?
Uh-oh, we're going to have to do some disclosure dun, 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 dun. Here. Don't use any soap. No, that's not true. I do use soap, but I use Dove. What do you use, Christy?
In my kitchen, I use antibacterial soap, and then everywhere else, it's sort of like whatever we have.
Yeah, this is a tough question because, first off, you're talking to physicians, and we wash our hands like 40,000 times a day, two pumps of the antibacterial cleansers that we're all walking around every time we enter the room and exit the room. But in general, I think it's a great question here because it turns out there's very little data that the use of antibacterial soaps, particularly in the home, have had real benefit for people, and there may be risk.
And in fact, we have millions of bacteria that live in the world, and there is some sort of balance of that that is natural. And so it really does raise a question of how much of this antibacterial soap is actually a good thing. I think, you know, with me and young children in the house and colds and, you know, all kinds of viruses, it makes me feel better to come home and wash with that antibacterial soap one more time.
But you could use regular soap.
Yeah.
You don't have to use the antibacterial
soap.
It'll probably
be just as good.
Things like Dial or Lever 2000. There are specific antibacterial soaps. And sometimes we'll say to use those if you have conditions where you have bacterial overgrowth in your armpits or other areas, and we're trying to lower the bacterial count. But in the absence of those specific indications, probably regular soap.
It's probably
for most
fine.
People, just fine. Great question. Erica, what's our very next house call?
My mother is 95 years old and lives in a nursing facility in the area. She has Alzheimer's disease and needs assistance with all daily tasks. Her skin is so thin that if for those assisting her apply too much pressure or she bumps into something, her skin either bruises horribly or it tears open. I know thinning of the skin is normal as we age, but what do you suggest that I do to help her prevent from having wounds all over her?
Oh, well, that's sweet that you were taking care of her and asking this question. One thing that comes to my mind is to just check her medication list. If she's taking a baby aspirin or if she's taking any medications that could thin the blood, that could make it...
Like prednisone.
Yeah, that much easier for her to have bruising or breakdown of the skin.
Make sure she's not taking vitamin E, which might be a common thing that some elderly people are taking. The other thing is that patients, as they get older, as we all get older, our skin does become thinner.
Mm-hmm.
So keeping it moisturized in general to keep the skin from getting dried out is in general a really good idea. So common things, talk with your doctor, talk with a nurse, see if she's having moisturizer on her skin, and good luck, and thank you for taking care of her.
So let's take our very last house call question from our executive producer.
I was cleaning my bathrooms the other day with my go-to items, Clorox and Soft Scrub. All of a sudden, I had this burning sensation in my chest. What do you think this is, and what are the dangers of accidentally ingesting cleaning products?
Well, I think what it is you accidentally ingested cleaning products, which, oh my goodness, that is not a good thing.
It's not. And, you know, you can, if you drink those things, and this is why we counsel parents when children start getting around or getting into trash cans, even drinking a small amount of some of these cleaners can cause kind of what we call chemical burns in the esophagus. Like, you can really damage yourself by drinking these kinds of chemicals.
And the fumes can be very damaging to the lungs and the eyes. And
you can get lightheaded or dizzy just from smelling it. I do.
When I go into restaurants after they've cleaned off the table and they sit you down, sometimes I can't sit at that particular table because they've cleaned it down with Windex or other things that, are emitting fumes. If you can smell these fumes, they're probably not a good idea to be around them, really.
That's true. I mean, so you could put on a little mask or sort of cover your nose and mouth when you're doing it with some gloves, or try to look for other cleaners that don't that aren't quite as hard on your body.
Yeah, a lot of times people will use baking soda to clean or to soften the water. Soap, just regular soap, works really well. Some people use lemon. I've heard of white vinegar. I don't have a lot of experience with that. And there's a lot of times in these natural products, there's citrus solvents, I think orange and lemon and other things that they are completely organic. And I don't think, other than the smell of citrus fruit, are toxic.
Well, we have had some great questions to get today. Thank you for yours about Clorox and chemicals for cleaning and how that can hurt you, about thin skin as we age and ways to prevent wounds.
About antibacterial soaps versus plain soaps, and is there any real benefit?
And about degenerative disc disease and trying to prevent that and improve from that over time.
We want to thank you for joining us today for your health, and we hope we have addressed issues and concerns that are important to you, and you can share your questions, stories, and comments to email us at yourhealth@unc.edu.
You can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org, and you can follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, and our health app. To get that on your phone, just search Your Health, one word, for a free download from the App Store.
We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare, for their sponsorship. Our guest today, Dr. Diane Shannon, and our executive producer, Erica Lloyd. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
We'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.